This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McKee. After refusing to commit to a peaceful transfer of power if he loses the election, U.S. President Donald Trump says that he is not sure the election can be honest. AP's Ed Donahue.
The president said it's a scam.
Unsolicited ballots. They're unsolicited. Millions being sent to everybody.
He told reporters if America votes this way, it can't be honest.
They found, I understand, 8 ballots in a waste paper basket in some location. They found, it was reported in one of the newspapers that they found a lot of ballots in a river.
On Capitol Hill, FBI Director Christopher Wray says there is no history of a coordinated voter fraud effort for a national election.
Whether it's by mail or otherwise.
Wray says to change the outcome at that scale
would be a major challenge for an adversary. But people should make no mistake, we're vigilant.
Ray says voter fraud is on their radar. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Activists in Louisville, Kentucky, and other U.S. cities have been out again chanting Breonna Taylor's name and marching for a second night after a decision not to charge officers with killing the black woman. A police in riot gear blocked roads Thursday night, but they did keep their distance as the crowd streamed through the streets in Taylor's hometown. Protesters also gathered in cities like Philadelphia and Rochester, New York. More than 3.5 years into his presidency and 40 days from an election, President Trump is launching what each term a vision for health on health care, heavy on unfulfilled aspirations. Mr. Trump spoke Thursday at an airport hangar in a swing state, North Carolina, to a crowd that includes white-coated, mask-wearing healthcare workers. He signed an executive order covering a range of issues, including protecting people with pre-existing medical conditions. This is VOA News. China, Russia, and the United States have now clashed at the United Nations. This is over the responsibility for the coronavirus pandemic. They traded allegations about who mishandled and politicized the virus in one of the few real-time exchanges among top officials at this year's COVID distance UN General Assembly meeting. The sharp exchanges reflect the deep divisions among the three veto-wielding council members. Those disputes have escalated since the virus first emerged in the Chinese city of Wuhan. The remarks at the Security Council came just after UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres criticized the lack of international cooperation in tackling the out-of-control coronavirus. And globally, there are more than 981,000 people who have died from COVID-19. Well, there are more than 32.1 million confirmed infections worldwide. AP correspondent Zaria Shackler reports that scientists continue to scramble to develop a vaccine that will protect the public from a pandemic that has already killed nearly 1 million people worldwide.
AstraZeneca CEO Pascal Soriot and Paul Stoffels, chief scientific officer of Johnson & Johnson, say that they recognize the coronavirus emergency demands increased transparency from vaccine developers to ensure the public has faith in the end product. They stress, however, that there are limits to the information they can release because they must protect patient confidentiality and the integrity of their scientific research. Soriot says ultimately the public will have to trust regulators around the world and the independent experts that oversee drug trials. Zaria Shackley, London.
Prominent Hong Kong activist Joshua Wong was arrested Thursday for taking part in a protest at the height of the city's pro-democracy unrest last year, but he vowed to continue resisting China's crackdown on dissent. He was arrested for unlawfully assembling over a 2019 demonstration against a government ban on face masks that was imposed before the coronavirus pandemic. The arrest of the territory's most high-profile dissident is the latest in a string of arrests for government critics and comes after China imposed a sweeping new national security law on Hong Kong in late June. Rio de Janeiro has delayed its annual carnival parade, saying that the global spectacle cannot go ahead in February because of Brazil's continued vulnerability to the coronavirus pandemic. The president of Rio's League of Samba Schools was announcing that the spread of the coronavirus has made it impossible to safely hold the traditional parades that are a cultural mainstay and for many a source of livelihood. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 25th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Mali's transitional president and vice president will be inaugurated today, Friday.
People can't wait for this to happen so that the ECOWAS can release the sanctions. And according to the sanctuary, they said as soon as the president is sworn in, the sanctions will be lifted by the ECOWAS.
Thousands in northern Mozambique face hunger as conflict there escalates. The Kenyan government is sued for alleged killings and rights violations by police. And Cameroon journalists call for the unconditional release of their jailed colleagues.
We have strongly condemned the arrest of our colleagues who went out to report the protest, and they were picked up arbitrarily and detained. This is terrible for our democracy.
COVID-19 restrictions and poverty intersect in Ghana's second-hand clothing market. And Zimbabwe's Rescue Wildlife joins Jerusalem Dance Challenge. The stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Mali, former Defense Minister Bad Ndao is scheduled to be installed as the country's transitional president today, Friday. Colonel Assimi Goïta, the leader of the military junta that toppled former President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta's government, is also expected to be inaugurated as vice president. The new government will lead the country for the next 18 months before handing over to a democratically elected government. Friday's inauguration is likely to satisfy the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, which had made the installation of the transitional leadership a prerequisite to lifting sanctions that it imposed on Mali. VOA's Peter Clotty spoke with Salif Tigana, the CEO of Tigana Technology, about Friday's inauguration.
According to the sources that I talked to, most of them will say that people are just can't wait for this to happen so that the ECOWAS can release the sanctions. And according to the sanctuary, they said it's going to be automatic. As soon as the president is sworn in, the sanctions will be lifted by the ECOWAS. And also there was a survey going on asking the Malian people what they think of the president that was chosen. Majority of people are satisfied with the choice.
Have Malians accepted the fact that within the next 18 months, this transitional leadership will organize an election and hand over to a legitimately elected president?
Yeah, but there are some people who are not happy with the process of designating the president of transition. And that example is M5. M5 has publicly said that they were not happy with the process. Although they did not condemn it or reject the president, but they have said that the fact that they were not involved in decision making, that is something that frustrates them. But so far, they did not say we don't want that president. People are now looking forward for the president to be sworn in and choose the prime minister and see what will be the following.
So did the M5 say what they are going to do next, since they are not happy?
Yeah, the spokesman from M5 has publicly spoken about this, and he said they were not happy by the process. The military chose to designate the president, but he did not say what would be the following actions if, in case they didn't come back or maybe choose somebody else or to involve them in decision-making. Probably, I don't know, they want to do something. They express situation. Even the imam himself has expressed some of the regret because M5 is not involved on choosing the president.
Are Malians enthusiastic or happy about having a new transitional leader that would hand over in the next 18 months for elections, both parliamentary and presidential, to be held?
Yeah, I think the majority of Malians are happy because, you know, a lot of Malians were expecting the president of transition to be a military. Most Malians would say we want a military to be in the transition.
What has been the reaction of supporters of the former president who was toppled by the military?
Yeah, that's something very weird because they are very happy with the choice. So people are like shocked to see, okay, now they are complacent with the guru, like someone who toppled their president, and now they're happy with them. But the reason is very simple, because they don't want to see someone from M5 to be a president, to be a president of transition. So they're happy. It's not a politician. It's not in the other side.
Salif Tigana is the CEO of Tigana Technology of Mali. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotte from the Malian capital, Bamako. Cameroon's Journalism Association has called on authorities to stop harassing reporters and to immediately and unconditionally release journalists who were detained while covering Tuesday's opposition protests. Police incarcerated at least 8 journalists covering the anti-government protest, searched the homes of 4 of them, and seized or destroyed their equipment. While most were released yesterday, Thursday, press groups called the detentions illegal. Moki Edwin Kizeka reports from Yaoundé.
Ty Jarvis Mai, a freelance journalist, returned Thursday to his office in the English-speaking southwestern Cameroon town of Boya. Mai says he was arrested by police in the French-speaking coastal city Douala on Tuesday while reporting on protests against President Paul Biya. He spoke via a telephone call from Boya.
The man in uniform asked, why am I using my phone to film them? I said, yeah, I'm on a Skype call. So they took us to that brigade from Abberi, one drinking alcohol, poured the whiskey on me, asked me to drink, and it just poured on my head. We're in an airtight cell. We fell for about 2 people that were 15 and over. With no food, our phones were confiscated. They took everything from us.
Mai said he was forced to sit on the ground for 7 hours. He said he was released Wednesday at 6 p.m. after pressure from journalism associations and several international rights groups. Jude Viban, president of the Cameroon Association of English-Speaking Journalists, says Mai was arrested with 7 other reporters in the capital Yaoundé and Douala. Viban says he strongly condemns the illegal detention of journalists in Cameroon.
We have strongly condemned the arrest of our colleagues who went out to report and not to support the protest, and they were picked up arbitrarily and detained in facilities without communication, without access to their lawyers, without access to their colleagues. This is terrible for our democracy, and unfortunately it keeps happening.
On Thursday, the National Syndicate of Cameroon Journalists reported that the homes of 4 journalists were searched by police. The report said phones, recorders, and computers were seized. Rights activist Andel Ben Vomo says Cameroon is becoming notorious for its abuses on the rights of journalists.
Est-ce que c'est normal alors que ces journalistes soient interpellé de façon violente?
He says it is very wrong for the police to violently brutalize, beat, and give corporal punishment to journalists who are simply doing their job of informing the people. Cameroonian police and the Minister of Territorial Administration did not react to the accusation when contacted by VOA. The Committee to Protect Journalists said Thursday that police are still holding one of the arrested journalists, Ludovic Ndiou. The Committee to Protect Journalists said it has not forgotten what happened to journalist Samuel Wazizi, who died in police custody in August 2019, but whose body has yet to be seen. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The United Nations World Food Programme says northern Mozambique's volatile Cabo Delgado province is facing hunger crisis as escalating conflict forces thousands to flee their homes and abandon farms. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
An armed insurgency in Mozambique's oil-rich northern province of Cabo Delgado has displaced more than 300,000 people since 2017. As fighting has intensified in recent months, thousands have fled to neighboring Tanzania, raising fears of a regionalization of the conflict. Most of the displaced have no means to feed themselves, and WFP spokesman Thompson Feary says many are totally dependent on international food aid for survival.
We know that Cabo Delgado is a farming area. This is a region that produces both crops for commercial as well as for the subsistence of the farmers there. And we know that when there is violence and if a farmer is not guaranteed that he will be there to harvest, they hardly put any seed into the ground.
The WFP plans to send food aid to reach 310,000 people in Cabo Delgado, Nampula, and Niassa. But it notes insecurity, poor infrastructure, and restrictions imposed by the COVID-19 pandemic and lack of money are threatening the operation. Fieri says the agency urgently requires $4.7 million a month to assist the internally displaced. He tells VOA the WFP will be forced to cut back on rations as early as December if it doesn't receive the needed funds. This, he adds, will have serious consequences.
When you cut rations, the adults, particularly the mothers in the families, they start skipping meals. They start reducing the meal portions in order to stretch whatever resources are available for the children to have something. So we are also concerned because Cabo Delgado has very high malnutrition rates.
Cabo Delgado has the second highest rate of chronic malnutrition in the country, with more than half of children under age 5 chronically malnourished. The UN agency has enough money in its coffers to feed the internally displaced over the next couple of months. The WFP, however, warns it may be forced to suspend its life-saving operation if the funding shortage persists beyond the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butter in Washington. Today is Friday, September 25th. Four human rights groups in Kenya are suing the government over alleged killings and human rights violations by Kenyan police as they enforced a curfew to stop the spread of the coronavirus. The rights groups are seeking legal reforms and monetary compensation on behalf of victims. Rael Ombuo reports from Nairobi.
The rights groups Amnesty International Kenya, International Justice Mission Kenya, Haki Africa and Kituo cha Sheria says police use the nighttime curfew to violate the rights of victims at a critical time. Annette Mbogo is executive director of Kituo cha Sheria, also known as the Legal Advice Center. She explained the decision to sue the government.
Within the pandemic, that's when the government responsibility towards its people should be even higher than when things are just as normal. During this time, there was a much higher responsibility of the police to ensure that they protect as opposed to meeting violence against the citizenry. So we feel that the issues being brought in this case are unique in that respect.
The petition included demands for long-term legislative reform aimed at addressing cases of alleged police brutality in the country.
This is not the first time that these incidents have been happening. What is different in this particular case is that, one, we are not just seeking an administrative decision, but we are seeking a court decision, a declaratory decision from the court that spells out the importance of the police not using excessive force as they execute their mandate. Number two also is that we are asking the court to ensure that there is one particular department or a cabinet secretary who will be assigned with implementing the legislation that relates to protection of the citizenry from excessive force.
The petitioners include 5 family members of people who were allegedly killed by police during curfew enforcement. One of them is Hussein Moyo Molte, whose son, 13-year-old Yasin Moyo, was shot on the balcony of his house in Nairobi's Kiamaiko neighborhood in March. Duncan Diema, the police officer who allegedly killed Yasin, pleaded not guilty to murder charges and was later released on cash bail pending trial. Yasin's father says he hopes he will get justice through the trial or possibly through the lawsuit. He said, "What we are looking for is justice. I have not seen an officer come to me and tell me that they are on my side. I am working with those holding my hand. The case may or may not succeed, but the most important thing is that we are standing and demanding for justice." In June, The Independent Policing Oversight Authority, IPOA, a government institution that watches the work of the police in Kenya, said there had been 15 deaths linked to police action during curfew enforcement since March. Nairobi human rights activist Rama Wako says the number could be higher. She says, we have filed so many cases such as this in the past. Yasin's moved fast because of the media attention and involvement from rights bodies. Because of that, there is a chance that there might be justice. But we have so many cases where we do not always have the media and others on board. In such, justice is always a challenge. In recent months, Kenya's government has relaxed most of the country's coronavirus restrictions and shortened curfew hours. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
A Ghanaian artist has been documenting the journey of secondhand clothing imported in Ghana and the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on those who rely on this trade. Authorities say they are reinforcing a ban on imported secondhand undergarments due to fears that the clothing could further stress public health. But some Ghanaians say the prohibition further impacts livelihoods already strained due to the pandemic. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
Multimedia artist Sal Kofiga documents the many hands that imported second-hand clothing and fabrics passed through in the bustling Kantamanta market in Accra, which largely deals with goods discarded by the West.
In this process of distribution, you get people who are carrying these goods on their shoulders and then on their heads to warehouses, to shops and all these things. And then we have people who pull the bills on trucks and then distribute them to other places. So before the shirts even or the dress even gets to the unknown person who is coming to buy it, there is a lot of work that goes into it. And that is where I am more like interested in trying to see how these things affect people.
Kofiga's work focuses on the complex challenges within the market, including people's livelihoods and the excess production the market represents. Prior to the pandemic, American NGO The Orr Foundation estimated about 15 million items arrived weekly and that about 40% ended up discarded. That means, aside from the livelihoods this trade supports, Ghana is burdened with discarding what the West doesn't want. The coronavirus, which causes the COVID-19 disease, has had a major impact here. Fewer imports are coming in and buyer demand has decreased. Those who live on daily wages are especially vulnerable. They have been reliant on NGOs and charitable support to survive, market worker Abdulai Rukaya says.
Because of the COVID, the business come down. Even I have a child. Even the whole of the day, if I don't get something, how can my child feed?
While those in the market wait for work to pick up again, there are concerns over a clampdown on some items after authorities said they were reinforcing an existing ban over fears some imports could spread diseases. Legislation banning secondhand undergarments, mattresses and sanitary ware took effect in 1994 due to health fears and concerns Ghana was being used as a dumping ground. But some of these items can still be found in the markets. A Ghana Standards Authority officer said porous borders are partly to blame, but added the current clampdown has led to a huge reduction in these items. NGO People's Dialogue on Human Settlements says there are negative implications for bans like this for those who rely on selling these goods and those who buy them due to their cheaper price. Abdul Muhib Salifu, a program manager at the NGO, says focusing on upgrading the market would be more useful and believes people have always been careful to wash anything bought from the market.
The informal economy, we like it or not, plays a very big role in government's management of economic situations. So sometimes when politicians try to raise, they just see one law somewhere and then they ask them and they say, that law, it bans these people from this. We are going to enforce it. You can't enforce laws when you don't create alternatives.
For his part, artist Kofiga also turns fabrics from the market into upcycled clothes, which he hopes will inspire a greener global fashion industry. Kofiga says he doesn't want secondhand garment imports into Ghana to cease, but that he just wants to highlight the excessive waste fast fashion creates and to inspire people to have a better appreciation for what still has some use. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
As the dance challenge known as Jerusalema spreads across Africa, staff at the Zimbabwe Sanctuary for Rescue Wildlife have seen their online dance video with elephants, giraffes, and other animals go viral. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Those are officials at the Zimbabwe Wildlife Rescue Center, Wild is Life, joining in the Jerusalem Dance Challenge, a South African internet craze sweeping the continent. The song Jerusalem by South African DJ and record producer Master KG and vocalist Nomncebo went viral during the coronavirus lockdown. Dancers, both professional and amateur, began posting their performances to the song online, including with some wildlife. Roxy Dankwes, the founder of Wild is Life, says they use their phones to record the video. Dankwes says they made the video just to ease lockdown boredom with their employees.
I think, you know, we've already had an amazing response. We didn't expect that to happen at all, that it would go viral. And, yeah, I hope that it'll spread further and get more people involved in the challenge. But really, it's about, for us particularly, just spreading awareness of animals and the sentience of animals and the importance of animals for our national heritage, basically, for our children and for our country.
Dankwes says she hopes it will help support Zimbabwe's wildlife tourism industry. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
For Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with Patrick Seeley, Kenyan long-distance runner who has been banned for 3.5 years for fleeing from anti-doping officials who are trying to collect a sample. Patrick Seeley is the latest in a long line of Kenyan athletes to be sanctioned in recent years, including 2008 Olympic 1,500 meters champion Asbel Kiprok, former Boston and Chicago marathon winner Rita Jepto, and 2016 Olympic marathon champion Jemima Sumgong. The Athletics Integrity Unit Global Disciplinary Body said in a statement that Patrick Seeley ran away from anti-doping personnel, and an independent witness confirmed he huddled a fence to escape from the compound in Kapsabet in West Kenya on December 18th, 2019. In the meantime, Athletics Kenya has shortlisted 54 athletes for Saturday's dry run ahead of the Kipkino Classic due October 3rd at the Nyayo National Stadium. Athletics Kenya Senior Vice President Paul Mutui said the test events will involve 200 meters, 400 meters, and 800 meters, both men and women, and 4x400 meters mixed relay races. And now to Uganda, where a mobile telecommunications firm has awarded Joshua Cheptegei with $33,000 following his record-breaking performance at last month's Diamond League meeting in the French municipality of Monaco, where he set a new 5,000 meters world record of 12 minutes 35.36 seconds, breaking Kenenisa Bekele's 16-year-old world record of 12 minutes 37.35 seconds. Joshua Cheptegei, while receiving his award, said government should focus on building sports infrastructure in Uganda to encourage future record breakers.
We need to invest more in the sport. We need to invest more in the infrastructure. If we can have different stadiums, playgrounds across the country developed well, we will really make Uganda a tourism destination in the years to come.
In wrestling, President of Nigeria Wrestling Federation, Daniel Igale, is seeking the support of the Nigerian government to become the first black African in the United World Wrestling Bureau. Daniel Igale believes Nigeria has not done well in sports politics and is hoping that if Nigeria secures the seat, it will be a huge boost to the development of wrestling in the country and on the continent.
One of the things Nigeria hasn't done very well is in sports politics. What we're trying to do is to get into the Bureau so that we can also have the necessary support for African wrestling and for Nigeria particularly. I think my being there will immensely benefit not only Nigeria but Africa.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, September 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.